This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright and Brock Rahm.
Well, I'm excited to get technical. These guys kind of roll their eyes a little bit when we get technical.
But I don't know if roll my eyes is fair. You know, they might gloss over a little bit, but I don't know if they ever roll.
Since the pandemic began, technology has helped us overcome challenges and meet new demands. Mike Downey of Microsoft is here to help us understand where technology and content intersect and how we can better leverage what's available to us to improve our work.
Are we going to time.is here, guys?
Oh, yeah. So, we just all go to time.is and we clap to make it easier to sync in post. We really don't have to do it, but it's a running joke now at the start of our podcast. So we have to do it every podcast. But what it is we'll just pick a second interval to have everybody clap on. And when the clock changes to that interval, we all clap.
Okay.
So let's do 44.
Ooh. Bang.
That was tight.
I liked it. All right. Away we go.
Hey, what's going on? It's Justin. Just wanted to give a shout out to APM for providing the track for us here on the Creative Sports Podcast. We're doing this podcast as an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're finding us and aren't a member of the community yet, you can sign up for free at sportscreativeslack.com. Today, we're going to get into sports technology, and we have Mike Downey joining us. He is on the commercial software engineering team at Microsoft. He has helped lead the engineering efforts for most of Microsoft partnerships in sports since 2012, including partnerships with the NBA, PGA Tour, NASCAR, NFL, USGA, PGA of America Ryder Cup, Hendrick Motorsports, and Real Madrid. He has a background in data science and product management with an emphasis on media and entertainment scenarios. So, Mike, thank you so much for joining us and being willing to talk sports tech with us here.
Hey, thank you for having me, guys. I'm really excited about this. This is my favorite subject, sports technology. So I'm very happy to be here.
So along the conversation, we'll get into a little bit of esports and what you see, your experience working with Cloud9. We'll talk about the impact of COVID, which I think I'll probably jump in with here because that's how I got introduced to you. And then we can also touch on some of the evolution of how data is used in sports and Microsoft's sports technology portfolio a little bit there as well, and some trends going on. So how you first got on my radar was posting about what was going on with the bubble when the NBA was going back to the bubble. And I know you lead strategic partnerships with the NBA and work closely with them. So can you give us a little bit of a background on maybe one of the biggest challenges that you faced during COVID when all of this happened, of making sure that fans could be part of that experience when the NBA went down to Orlando for the bubble?
Yeah. So we have a multi-year partnership with the NBA at Microsoft that we started early in 2020. I think it was about April when we announced the deal, which, you know, a lot was going on in April of 2020. A lot was changing in the world. And so it really coincided with the start of that pandemic. The nature of our partnership is very much focused on helping the NBA develop their next generation, what they call the direct-to-consumer platform, which is basically all the services involved in getting the game broadcasts from the court out to fans' hands through digital platforms. So your phone, your set-top box, things like that. So everything other than like cable and traditional TV. So that's like where we spend most of our time. But like I said, it happened to coincide with the start of the pandemic. So as, you know, things started, you know, the league started to figure out, okay, well, they stopped play for a while, and then there was a pause in time, and then there was the decision to kind of restart play, but do it in, you know, the COVID bubble in Orlando, where everybody was, sealed off from the rest of the world. The first question I think that came up with them was, what is the fan experience going to be like, right? Well, obviously, it's all televised, all broadcast, but it's in an empty arena. And that has a major effect on the game, right? Like we've never really had that experience before, right? We're watching pro sports with no fans. And so, you know, a lot of creative brainstorming went on. They asked us for ideas, how we could help. And they really come up with the idea to surround three sides of the court with huge video walls, tiled video, and then try to find a creative way to put the fans on video as if they're sitting there in the arena. And it just, like, there's a lot of ways to do that, a lot of different technologies that can do that. But at the time, the timing was just perfect. We at Microsoft were just about to announce a new feature for our Microsoft Teams client, which is similar to Zoom. It's our version of Zoom. And the feature we were about to announce was called Together Mode. And what that does is it takes, instead of the Brady Bunch, you know, tiles that we're used to for group video chats, this mode basically would green screen out each person and place them in stadium seating in the video view. So you see everybody sitting like they're in an auditorium together. And we were planning on, you know, coming out with that within like a month of the NBA's need for it. And so the timing was perfect. So we said, hey, this might actually look better on your video wall than if you went with that kind of tiled interface. It would look more natural. And so they were excited. So, you know, that's what we ended up doing with them is using the Microsoft Teams client for all of those games in the bubble. And we had like President Obama, Shaq, like all kinds of celebrities that all showed up on screen. So it was a really neat experience. You know, it was about as good as you can do remotely under those circumstances.
Teams is really kind of at the hub of my workflow. My office is all Teams. And I've seen so many market improvements through COVID. How much did this pandemic accelerate development in that sphere? Obviously, we've seen it on other platforms like Zoom and stuff. Like, all of a sudden, everybody's going digital. But how much did it accelerate, and how much did you already have in the pipeline? Like you were talking about, I know this is a little sports adjacent, right? But how much did it accelerate those workflows versus how much you had in the pipeline?
Well, I think I've read enough of the different articles that have been written and interviews that our teams have done on that subject to know that. It focus on Teams and new features and scaling was exponentially grew through the pandemic. I mean, any business out there who's doing any kind of web conferencing, video conferencing during, you know, the outbreak of the pandemic, they all went, you know, everything got dialed up to 11. It was completely nuts because the usage just shot up. Obviously, if we're not going into the office, then everybody's meeting online. So that, like, our team, I mean, hats off to them and any other team, you know, the Zooms and everyone else out there, WebEx, who have been able to keep their services up and running. Because, I mean, that's for just any product team to have to deal with a scenario like that where your users just skyrocket is really, really difficult to do. So there's that. So, yeah, obviously they spent a tremendous amount of effort on not just keeping everything running, but adding the features that people needed. But I think what you're probably most interested in is how did the pandemic and this massive growth in audience really change things, particularly, you know, within the lens of sports and fan engagement. And I think one thing that we've learned out of the last year from a fan, like from a fan engagement perspective, is that one, there's a need for more signal and less noise nowadays, more so than ever before. We've shifted our mindsets so much towards finding our entertainment online now than we did a year ago. You know, like we've been doing it. Netflix has been, you know, and those scenarios have been really popular, but this just completely accelerated everything where we seek out all this entertainment. And as a result, content providers have been just inundating the market. All of us are getting inundated with new subscription services. You have Peacock and you have Disney Plus, and there's so many services now and so many different ways to get content that out of that, you know, while we're building the NBA's next generation platform, we're all thinking about like, okay, how do we cut through all of that? How do you continue to get to the fans when they have more choices for entertainment today than they ever have before? And a lot of that comes down to things that we're going to talk about later in this podcast and know, but around using technology to personalize the content. And how do you figure out like what's the best time to tell someone that there's new content available? Or how do you craft that in a way that it's more interesting to them? How do you figure out who their favorite teams and players are? How do you predict what type of clip they're going to be interested in? Like, there's a lot of different NBA clips that I can send to you. How do I get more signal? How do I predict what you're going to want to watch? So those are all the really big challenges. And that's across the entire media and entertainment space, is you're fighting through so many more competitors for attention now that it's a massive technology challenge.
In your role, when you're developing strategies and you're developing solutions for these strategic partnerships, right? Are you reaching into a well of really kind of pre-developed Microsoft solutions and adjusting them to fit? Or is it a lot of ground up type R&D work that's going into these things that are really custom solutions that then can fit back into the Microsoft ecosystem, maybe in a different way?
That's a great question. So when Microsoft and other big tech companies, typically when we do a partnership in sports, that means that we're putting money out there as a sponsor, as well as looking for the organization we're sponsoring to be investing in our own technology platform, right? So it's all very rooted in technology. And when we do that, when we do it, we're doing it for a variety of reasons. One of those being exposure of our brand in a positive way, so that whatever impact our technology has on that sport, that the fan, and this is very fan focused, not business focused, but fan focused, we want the fan to be using, you know, experiencing that sport, seeing our logo and seeing some tech that we've added to it that makes their experience better. That's our goal, right? We want to improve the experience so they go, oh, that new thing is cool. Oh, and Microsoft was behind that. I like Microsoft more now. Like, that's the basics of mm-hmm. it, right? And so with that in mind, when we enter into these types of partnerships, we're usually looking for some opportunity for innovation, like something where we can go in and solve a real authentic problem that that sport has. And believe me, I've met with many prospective partners who clearly were telling me things that they thought I wanted to hear as a potential sponsor. But in talking with them, it was clear that the thing they were suggesting we could solve for them wasn't really a problem for them, right? And so we seek that out. Like, NBA needed a new direct-to-consumer platform that was revolutionary beyond what they're doing today. And for us, we said, that's a perfect challenge for us because those are things that we're not doing today. But we felt that with the tools that we have, the services that we have, and the engineering expertise that we have, we could pull that together and create something new with the NBA together. So it's really more the former in the scenarios you asked. It's we seek out those innovations, but we obviously also want to show off our products as best as possible along the way.
Well, I know just beyond the NBA, obviously you work with some other organization, esports, those kind of things. And I'm just curious what it's like working with an established brand like the NBA that maybe is a little more, you know, big, you know, they're less willing to maybe experiment in the same way that maybe you can in some of the esports spaces or the less established spaces. What are some of the different positives and the different challenges between working with an established league and, you know, maybe someone who's a little newer to the market?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's you really have even a third category, which is that you've got like the traditional sports who are very set in their tradition, right? And I think this is really prevalent in golf, right? Like, golf is very much about the tradition of the sport for good reason. Like, there's a lot of value. It's one of the old, in fact, it might be the oldest professional sport that's still being played at that level. So you have that, the tradition, and tradition can get in the way, right? Tradition can inhibit progress when your fan base, which is where your money's coming from, right? Like, if you can't get eyeballs, you're not going to sell sponsorship. You're not going to sell tickets, right? So tradition can be a block or an inhibitor to growth, especially as your fan base is evolving. And traditional sports is evolving, full stop, period. Like, what we may have grown up with, it no longer exists. Like, sports isn't it's a different audience now. And so you have the tradition. Then you have the very progressive, forward-thinking leagues that are traditional leagues, like the NBA. And frankly, I've worked with every major sports league out there and most of the major teams around the world, soccer teams, you know, European football. I would put the NBA at the top of the list in terms of a progressive mindset in a, we need to move, evolve, and adapt and change how we approach the game, all of that. And it's significant. And so I think they're kind of a middle category like that. Like, they're coming out of traditional sports, but they're looking for new ways to evolve. I will throw a bone to NASCAR. This would probably surprise a lot of people, but NASCAR has continued to impress the heck out of me in terms of their own progressive mindset, even on social issues, which I think would probably surprise a lot of people. But they've really been very progressive minded, and particularly around, you know, technology and evolving their product, because they have a challenge too. Like, their bread and butter was these massive in-person races, you know, and that's changing. But anyways, to get back to the point, esports. So on the third column, it's this whole new category of sports that it could hardly be more different. Like, it's still sports, but like, the fan base is very different. The way the fans engage with the sport is very different. And even the nature of a team. So we work with Cloud9 at Microsoft. We sponsor Cloud9. They're a team, but an esports team is really more of a team of teams. So Cloud9 has a number of competitive teams that all play different game titles, and they compete in different leagues, right? But they're all under the one brand, the umbrella of Cloud9. There's not really an analog to that in traditional sports. Like, there are holding companies that own, you know, the Red Sox and the, what is it, maybe Chelsea or Liverpool, I can never remember, but, you know, there's organizations, but that's it, right? Like, they don't, at Cloud9, they share strategy, they share resources, they share staff, coaching. So that's really unique. But I think what's really interesting, I think the most interesting thing that I've learned about esports in being fairly new to it a couple of years ago and learning a lot from Cloud9 is that the way they interact with their fans, it's so, to me, so authentic and so unscripted and so raw. Like, it's very non-corporate. Like, if people would describe like a polished marketing corporate message, that's like that, the esports audience picks that up so fast. And they have an allergic reaction to it, right? So it's a challenge for a sponsor to come in and fit in nicely with that fan base and not come off as inauthentic. And so, like, what we do with Cloud9 is we just came right off the bat and said, we're going to focus on your League of Legends team. That's their biggest team. And we're going to do a data science project where we dive into the data that comes out of the game. And we help you process that data. We help you find new data points that aren't available to you. And we help you turn that data into competitive strategy. And the reason we did that is we knew that if we could provide tools to Cloud9 that helped them win, that the fans would look at us and say, Microsoft helped Cloud9 win using technology. That's authentic. It makes sense. And I would say partially coincidentally, but hopefully, you know, there's a direct relationship. Right after we finished that project, Cloud9 went on and won the spring split, and they did exceptionally well. Like, they had a clear improvement in performance. We played a role in that. Obviously, there was a lot more to it than that. But yeah. So, anyways, I could go on and on forever about esports. It's a huge, interesting topic. But yeah, generally, that's what's really unique is the way they interact with their fans. It's very different.
Yeah, I mean, esports is such a new thing even to me. I've had coworkers who, you know, just absolutely love Twitch, and like, that is the only sports they watch is esports, and that has never been me. I always kind of, you know, it just never interested me, and for whatever reason, I got into, over this pandemic, I've gotten into a game that is esports heavy, Rocket League, and I'm terrible at it, to be, you know, completely clear, but I've started watching it and understanding it and appreciating why people get into it. And you're right, I do think it's that authentic connection that you get. And it's almost this sense as a consumer of being into something that is unique, that kind of holds this niche that not everyone has yet. And it's so interesting to watch the way people have just tapped into that as marketers, because I do think you're right that because these people view themselves, and I include myself in it when I say that, like, view themselves as watching this niche product to some extent that's obviously becoming less so, you know, they can see the inauthenticity immediately if people are just trying to cash in on it, because right, they know it inside and out. There are very few casual esports fans.
Right. It's the other thing that I talk about esports with my colleagues a lot and people that aren't familiar with esports at all, right? And a couple of things I tell them. One, if you want to understand it, if you're a marketer and you're trying to understand the business, you do need to spend time on Twitch, because Twitch is the center of so much of understanding esports. It's the culture, the vernacular, the inside jokes. Like those are really important in esports, and you need to spend time on Twitch and watching content and really being immerse yourself in that. One, two, you have to realize that unlike almost every traditional sport, excluding maybe golf and tennis, esports is a scenario where the fans can all play the same sport themselves. Yep. And often they are, right? Yep. When I watch football or basketball or baseball, like I don't play football or basketball or baseball, right? I may have in school, but the audience isn't playing the same sport. And even in golf, like I think it's less than 25% of PGA Tour fans ever play golf, right? It's a very small percentage. But in esports, totally different. In esports, most of the fans are playing the games. And so it creates a different dimension of fandom, which is I'm watching because I love the game, but I'm also watching because I'm trying to understand the game better so that I can learn and I can develop my own skills by watching pros play it. And that changes everything. Like that's very different than what we're used to in traditional sports.
Right. I think there's a perception when I watch regular sports and I watch LeBron James play, I think to myself, I can never do that. Right. But when I watch esports for a game I play, I sit there and I falsely think to myself, oh, I can do that. Like there's no physical attribute that I can physically see that separates me from this person. But then you go and try and play and you can't do it. Right. But to me, it's a little bit different of a relationship. Whereas when I'm watching regular sports, I'm watching people do things I know I could never do. Right. Whereas when I'm watching esports, I'm watching something that I think I can do, right? Or at least the barrier to me doing that seems lower, even though it's probably really
it's not. Huge. That yeah, barrier is huge, Brock.
But as a marketer, it's a very different approach, right? Because the fans I'm talking to as a marketer, they also play that game that I'm talking about, right? Mm-hmm. So the message I land, like I said, what we chose to do with Cloud9 and helping the LCS team use data to create a competitive advantage. Like that story resonates well with the fan base because they know what the data is. They know how the game works and they think like, oh, I wish I had that kind of data so I could improve my game. So it's an interesting dimension for a marketer that they otherwise don't have.
Mike, I mean, the way you talk about, you know, the marketing side of things and just demographic and some of those things that you touch on has been fascinating. And then you've also kind of gotten to the technical side. And I just am curious, you know, like how does your role break down as far as, you know, how you're spending your time as far as the marketing strategy side versus a little bit more kind of in the technical weeds of your products?
Yeah, I mean, I have an engineering background in product management. So my role at Microsoft has really been around representing. We generally, when we look at sports partnerships, we tend to have a kind of a three-person crew, or three roles played. One is a marketer. I'm not that person, but I work with the marketing person so much that I understand, you know, that based on the questions they ask and what they're looking for. And we work so closely together. Mine is the technical role. So generally I'm the one that's trying to figure out like, what kind of story could we tell to support what the marketer wants, like the story they want to tell. How can I use technology to help them tell that story? And in getting into the details of what are we talking about? What kind of resources do we need to do that? And what tech is involved? And do we have the capability to do that? And does that align with what Microsoft's product strategies are too, right? Like the corporation is going in a certain direction with certain technologies, like AI is really important to Microsoft. If I know that as the tech person and I sit down with Cloud9 or NBA or another league, then I can kind of translate what, you know, our marketer is talking about with what, you know, I think we can deliver on the tech side. And then the third component is generally someone who's more on the business side and thinking about like, how do we make all of this happen? And that can be anything from contracts to, you know, the logistics of the partnership and all of those fun, complicated things. So anyways, that's where I fit into all of that. And it's helping to upfront establish like, does this make sense for Microsoft from a technical standpoint? And then once we proceed with doing a partnership and we sign the contracts and we move forward. And this is where I am right now with our NBA relationship. It's all right, now we have to deliver. And we have, you know, a lot of people at Microsoft now that are working on the execution side of the NBA partnership. And now my role shifts more towards making sure that we're successful in delivering on our initial vision in laying out this partnership. So it's more of a product management mindset of, you know, defining like what's the success criteria for Microsoft, for the NBA, and, you know, all the moving pieces that we need to keep working over a multi-year process to deliver.
You talked a lot about audience to what Garrett was saying, which kind of surprised me, because usually when people are like, technology's over here, someone else worries about the audience and vice versa, or whatever. So can you talk us through, like, you laid out three different categories of clients. Can you talk us through how esports on the one end could translate technology wise into some of the other leagues and teams, more traditional sports that you mentioned, and how they could leverage that technology and information?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's hard to do this type of job well without really understanding like what are the motivations for implementing new technology, and like and that's where the marketing side comes in, right? Like, you have to understand like what's the story we're trying to tell, but you also have to understand like what's the problem that the customer, in this case, the sports league, what's the problem that they have? And authenticity is so important in these types of scenarios. If we try to solve a problem that doesn't exist, like, the fans are going to know that. They're going to figure that out. It's not hard to figure out, right? And so that's why you have to really understand their business, and you have to understand our side of it. Like, why are we getting into it, being the sponsor? Why are we getting into it? You have to understand all of those pieces. But to get to your specific question on esports technology, I think one, esports is a very immature industry, and they'll admit that. Anyone you talk to who's big in that business will admit that they're moving at lightning speed. I mean, it's crazy, the growth within esports, but it's still like they don't have the infrastructure around them operationally, the relationships with broadcasters and with sponsors and with equipment, like all of the things that you see in traditional sports, like that's all new in esports. And even just on the sponsor side, like, marketers are still trying to figure out, like, we know it's big. We know the sweet spot of 18 to 35 year old, that's the most coveted marketing, you know, segment. We know that this is huge for them, but we're not exactly sure like what we do about it. So there's a lot of ambiguity around all of that. So on the tech side, so there's certain things I talked earlier about fan engagement and how esports is really, really good at having a close, deep, authentic relationship with their fan base. And you can see that, like, just go on social media platforms and look at the interaction between the teams and their fans. And there's inside jokes and there's memes and there's all kinds of things that you immediately understand the difference there when you look at that conversation. And you go look at like an NFL or an NBA or any other traditional league and look at their interactions, totally different, like much more personal on the esports side. From a tech standpoint, there's things like social media tools and analytics and understanding of the audience, and how do you tailor the messaging and how do you personalize content. I found that esports teams are really, really good at using clips and small amounts of media to keep their audiences engaged. And they have teams of people who are just really adept at leveraging media that comes out of the events that they run, the live events, which are, you know, there's only so many of those, but they stretch that content into a lot of engagement beyond the live events, if you know what I mean. Whereas in traditional sports, so much of the value of the entire sport is just in the live game. Like, so much of the value is concentrated in that live moment. And once you're outside of the live moment, your value of your content just falls off a cliff. Like, that's one of the biggest challenges in traditional sports, is keeping audiences engaged in your sport outside of the live game, right? And that's something that I think esports is really, really good at. And so I think that's causing an evolution in how the traditional leagues are, like, who they're staffing up, Having social media people who are creating content that is more personalized and more targeted, and they're interacting with their fan bases more and things like that. From a raw tech standpoint, esports is that they're playing video games, right? So from a competition side, getting analytics and looking at strategy and stuff like that is a lot easier because you're not dealing with putting sensors on athletes. You're not dealing with players' unions and things like that. Whereas if you look at a traditional sport, there's all kinds of complexity in measuring athletic performance. And like players' unions don't, a lot of cases, don't want sensors put on the players because they don't want that data used against players in contract negotiations. And there's all kinds of levels of complexity there. But with a video game, it's really straightforward. Like a lot of the games have their own API, like League of Legends. So the publisher of the game lets me sign up as a developer to access the data from the game in a very clean format. So like it's a completely different situation. And I think what's happening is sports leagues have started to realize over the years that they need to get collecting as much data as possible, and they need to break through the players union objections, which part of that is showing the players how this data can be valuable for them individually. Like this data helps them. It can help grow their career. It can help them get better contracts. It can help them better interact with their fan base. So a lot of that is just, you know, an evolution in technology. And what we find is collecting the data is kind of old school now, largely commoditized. Like there's a lot of off the shelf sensor packages and stuff like that, that anyone can go get and outfit their team with. There's great providers like Catapult out there that have full all-in-one solutions that any team can use. For us, we try to focus further down the continuum. So there's collecting the data, and then there's understanding what the data means. That's really, really important. That's a little harder to do. But then there's the third and most valuable piece of that, which is make better decisions using data. And that's where we try to focus our efforts when we do competitive stuff, like we did with Cloud9, in really creating decision-making models and algorithms so that they can do A/B testing. They can do, you know, hey, let's try a strategy and let's measure how well that strategy worked so that going forward, we're not, you know, making the same mistakes again. Like that's where the biggest value is now, is using data to make better competitive decisions.
So you talked about the success of Cloud9 and the analytics to make decisions that have actual real world results. What is there another, partnership that you've done that's really kind of had a similar set of success? Maybe it's not results based on winning or losing, you know, maybe it's fan engagement based. What's been another, you know, big memorable moment for you and this team in the sports world?
Well, there's several, but I think one that stands out is the work that we did. I'll give you two examples, and they happen to both be golf, but we did a lot of work in golf, and I'm a golf fan, so I'll use those as examples. But we did one partnership with the PGA Tour, and we helped them build a solution that we called the Contextualizer. And it's from a IT standpoint, from computer science standpoint, I think it's fascinating. But when we first started working with them, they introduced us to a team of producers. It's like, I think it was like four people who they employ who are gurus of everything golf. Like these are four young people who eat, sleep, and breathe golf. And they have all these stats and historical stories all in their heads. And their job is to sit in the broadcast truck and watch the broadcast. And they have binders and spreadsheets and all this data in front of them. And they are mining it for interesting stats or stories or references from start to finish, and they're finding something interesting and they're sending that to the broadcast, to the producers so they can put it on air. Right. And they showed us that, and it doesn't scale well at all. Right. Like it's four humans that are largely irreplaceable. And frankly, there's a lot of content that they miss because they're human, right? Like they only know what's in their head and what they can go look up. And so we started a project where we tried to automate some of that. And it wasn't to replace the human. It was to mine their vast database of statistics. And it goes way, way back, so that we could present to them what's effectively a playlist of interesting stats and interesting stories to that human who's, that's their job. So instead of them having to think of it and go dig it up, we have a, an algorithm that's just creating this list of, here are things that are interesting based on the input, which is the live event, what's happening right now. And so with ShotLink at the PGA Tour, they know where every ball is and every shot that was just hit. We bring that as an input, and we see, like, I'll give you one example. Sergio Garcia hits his tee shot into a tree and the ball gets stuck in the tree. So he then has to climb up into the tree and hit, and he decides to actually climb up with his club and he hits the ball out of the tree. That's a huge moment, right? Like, that's a social media moment. That's a shareable clip. Like, that's going to get all kinds of attention. That's a moment where you, that's an input. You want to go find how often has something crazy like that happened and pull it all up. Find all the clips and the stats. How often does that happen? And that's an extreme example, but pull that all together. And we found, like, Phil Mickelson hitting a shot out of a hotel balcony during an event. Like, that's relevant. But the thing about sports is highlights and clips and stats are usually only interesting in context of a live event, right? On its own, if I show you Emmett Smith running a, you know, a, an off tackle up the middle touchdown run on its own out of nowhere, it's like, okay, yeah, he did that a lot. But if today, if Ezekiel Elliott runs that play, and then I say, hey, here's a clip of Emmett Smith doing the exact same thing against the same team in the same stadium, you know, 15 years ago, or however long ago it was, that clip is suddenly more interesting. So that's one scenario that we built with the PGA Tour.
So I do have a question about that, and a little technical, might be a little too inside baseball or too inside golf here for to get the sport right. But you're basically talking about database and metadata indexing and management on a really, really massive scale, right? But you're also talking about, you know, some sort of algorithm or some sort of adaptive or creative learning inside of there that's able to compare shot off unique structure, right? Or whatever that tag is, right? Is there an AI or something that is indexing this? Is there a human element to the indexation of that indexation? I'm not sure if it's a, word or not.
Indexing.
Indexation. the indexing of that, is there a human element? Is there an AI element? How is that really kind of working behind the scenes there for that massive amount of metadata?
Yeah. So there's no simple way to do it. And that is an opportunity for startups out there. Like, there's, if there was a way to, to make this easier and more turnkey. What we did and what generally has to be done is it's bespoke, it's custom. And it's really, there's two elements to it. One is trying to automate the collection of the metadata, and you can use AI like technologies. So for example, a lot of solutions leverage computer vision, which is teaching a computer to analyze video and to detect objects in the video. And that is an AI technology. And that's a good way to create metadata, right? So you can have a pipeline, a media pipeline, where you're ingesting the live game broadcast, and then you're immediately sending that through a computer vision algorithm. And the NBA does this today with Second Spectrum, which is a software company. That provides as a service to the NBA. They put, like, you know, like a dozen cameras around every arena, and they are taking all of that video footage, and they are calculating using just computer vision. They're calculating the real-time positioning of the players, the X's and Y's of where the players are on the court, all using vision. So you don't need to put sensors on players, right? So that's the metadata part. So there's a lot of things you can do to automate all of that generation of metadata. And by the way, like, you can do other interesting things that are often not thought of, which is like audience sentiment analysis or something like that. Like, while the game's going on and people are watching it live, can we monitor what people are saying about it on social media? And can we correlate those things together? Like, if I'm, you know, in charge of making my sport more interesting, like, that's probably a role somewhere, I want to be looking at, during a live event, what happened in the game that caused this other response from the fans. How can I measure that? NASCAR actually does that. They adapt their rules packages, even like a tire compound, and then they measure did that make the race more interesting, right? So they'll adjust their rules, and then they'll have all these different tools for measuring how audiences enjoy the race, how close are the cars, how far apart are they, things like that. And it'll correlate those things, those points of metadata. So that's one side of it. And then there's the, like, once you've automated the creation of the metadata, then the question is, what do you do with it, right? Like, how do you use that information to create a more entertaining product? And really, like, in sports, it all comes down to drama. Like, the only reason any of us watch sports is because of the drama. If every game were a landslide blowout, nobody would watch. You want those moments of tension. You know, is my team going to make a comeback, or are we going to hold the lead? Like, that's the only reason we watch, right? And so with metadata, with this, whether it's stats or, you know, historical data or whatever, you can take moments in even mundane moments in a sports broadcast. You can use metadata, even historical metadata, to create more context for the fans so that they understand there's something special going on. Or, you know, when you see Steph Curry hit a three-pointer, that's kind of boring because he hits them all the time. It's like, okay, he's hitting another one. But when you add some context around, like, a stat or something, like, or even saying, like, hey, Steve Kerr, his head coach, he used to be the greatest shooter of all time, or one of them, right? Can you find a clip when Steve Kerr was on the Bulls where he did something that Steph Curry's doing right now? That's creating drama in the moment, right? That's the kind of challenge that we have.
Right. As a former TV producer, and I'm sure my other TV producers listening to this, they want that AI automated storyline generator, yeah, like right, yeah, now, just pop it up on my screen. Like, hey, last time this was done, it was Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan did it, you know, because so much of a producer's job, like you talked about before, is manually finding these storylines, right? And utilizing your crew to help find these storylines. But yeah, niche market there for sure, but I'm sure every producer in the world would be begging for that.
We're trying to think of a way, because we've built this a couple of times and we're building something like this for the NBA right now, but it's such a niche market, right, and each league has very specific, unique requirements for it. So it's really hard for us to think of, like, is there a way we can, I wouldn't say create a product out of it, but productize it in a way that could be repurposed. And it's just hard to do. It's a small market, and every use case is very unique. It almost has to be a one-off every time.
Right, exactly. But the commercial for it, the case study commercial, right, would be great.
Right.
What you were bringing up there was interesting too. So getting into AI, machine learning a little bit more, you know, I'm aware of OCR, speech to text, facial recognition, which you had brought up. What other artificial intelligence, machine learning capabilities are sports technologists starting to leverage to surface some of that content to be able to deliver it?
Yeah, well, so there's things that we call cognitive services, which you just alluded to. We actually have these as a product where it's like a no-code environment where speech to text, text to speech, computer vision, image recognition, like OCR stuff, like all those types of things that are common, that have a lot of advanced algorithms behind them. We've kind of created those as services that anyone can just use on their own, right? So there's some of those things. But at the end of the day, a lot of this use of AI is kind of the term has been overused, and it gets applied in cases that aren't technically artificial intelligence. But it's one of those, like, you know, everybody gets it, fans get it, consumers get it, so we just keep using the term. But in sports, like, a lot of it is finding patterns in things, right? Like, that's a big part of what we use machine learning and you know, all those various technologies for. Some of it is like we're using a service that we have called LUIS, which is Language Understanding and Intent Service. And so that's like a natural language thing. So if I ask you a question like, how many times did Steve Kerr hit a three-pointer in the last 30 seconds of the game against an Eastern Conference rival or something like that, right? So there's a lot of things in that's a query, right? But it's a natural language query. So we have a service that'll pick that apart into pieces and figure out what was the intent of what I was saying, and then map that to actual database queries, right? So that's a AI-driven service that provides that capability, which is otherwise really, really hard to do.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So a lot of it is just like pattern finding. and then measuring, right? Like, can we find a pattern? Then can we test it within the algorithm to find out like a score of how accurate it is? Even with the PGA Tour example I gave earlier, that solution, the contextualizer solution we built, where it creates like a playlist of stuff that might be interesting right now, we added a scoring capability so that the producer, as he or she is looking through the list, could hit like a thumbs up, thumbs down. I can't remember what we either did, like a 5-star or thumbs up, thumbs down, but that's training the algorithm. Every time they do that, it says, okay, this person likes this result, so let's do more like that. Or if they sent it over to the on-air graphics package, it got a score like, hey, this is a good one. So you're trying to train it. It's effectively like AI is effectively like the machine gets better at what it's doing over time by you using it, right? You're training it that way. And so those are the types of things that we tend to do. And usually it's in either a competitive scenario, like the League of Legends stuff we do with Cloud9, or it's in a fan engagement scenario, which is more like, how do we personalize content to you, Justin, knowing like we know what clips you watch and what teams you follow. Can I use AI to craft a better message for you or to present a better video playlist to you so you're seeing only stuff that you're really going to be interested in?
Yeah, I think that's so cool because we're all getting in a time crunch, right? Creative, trying to take content and create it and, you know, move towards being able to spend more of your time in the creation mode as opposed to the surfacing of content mode, right? So I think that's all super valuable insight.
I think another opportunity that's aligned with what you guys do on the creative side is it would be great if there were better tools out there to help you know what content works and what content doesn't work, right? So before you even create the content, if you had better mechanisms to know your audience better so that you weren't wasting your time creating stuff that is less effective than what you could be spending your time on. You know, like, I think that's a big opportunity.
I think it kind of goes back to what you were saying about some of the OTT platforms too, right? We, you know, Netflix and Paramount Plus and Disney yep. Plus and all of those. Like, at the end of the day, I think people are looking at those as video services, but they're really data capture and behavior capture, yeah. right? Yeah. At the end of yeah. the day, that's what you're... Yeah. Netflix will surface content for you based on what you've previously watched. It's kind of going to exactly what you just mentioned. Like, how can we surface content? You're given the thumbs up or thumbs down. When it gets sent over, it gets rated higher. Like, OTT is really the point where yeah. you're going to get some of the behavioral statistics in addition to understanding what people like to watch and will watch and maybe even get into if they're watching a ton of I'll use Celtics as an example, Tatum and Brown. If they're watching a lot of Tatum and Brown content, you can keep surfacing more Tatum and Brown content. Can you go back into the library and right. You know, keep surfacing all that content? So there, right. I think there's a lot more there than what people actually see on the surface of that.
Yeah. And even with a Netflix example, I think a lot of people don't realize that Netflix is also using its audience data to figure out what type of original content they should create. Right. And that's they have a huge leg up on the traditional studios in what audience data they have. Like, they know popular actors and themes and locations and all of those things. They have all that analytics data. So when they greenlight a new show, like, they have all this data feeding into that. It's just like, you know, Amazon Video too, Amazon Prime Video. Think of all the data Amazon has on their audience, even your shopping data. That can all factor into them creating a new TV series. I mean, just think about that. It's mind-boggling to think about how this data can be used to create better products.
And then you got to market it differently, because that's terrifying. Like, I don't want to know that Amazon is recommending a series based on the ice cream sandwiches I bought or something.
And you know,
like,
they are too.
But they are. I know they are.
They definitely are.
I don't want to hear about it. That's the key. That's where the marketing side comes
Ignorance
in.
Ignorance is bliss. Yes.
You get a lot of rom-com recommendations. I only laugh and joke about that because I think my wife's watched three different series or three different movies, and it was the same lead actor in all of them. So you saying that totally makes sense. That's like, okay, yep. Well, you know, that's what the audience wants. They like they like that guy, and you know, 2018, 2019, 2020, he's the guy.
That's right. That's right.
That's really funny.
Who is it? Who are we talking about here, Justin? That's the key question.
I'm not sure. I don't know his name. He's a Netflix original star.
Well, there you go. What else? What have we missed here, guys?
Maybe trends.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously one of the exciting things about working in this space is, it's the pace of innovation, right? Like being in technology in general, right? The pace of innovation is just ridiculous. Like every day there's something new and different. And for me, like working at such a large tech company with such a broad portfolio of products and technologies, like there's just an endless supply of ideas and different directions we could go. I mean, it's difficult too, because working with the NBA, like we have so many things that we could be figuring out a way to incorporate into our NBA relationship that a lot of it is just trade-offs and like, where should we spend our time and all of that. But around technology trends and the direction everything is going, I think the big conversation right now is just around like the post-COVID world, right? How did COVID permanently change the way we consume entertainment content, the way we, you know, the way we interact with other people? We look at things like from an OTT perspective, over the top, just, you know, digital video delivery. We think about now like, okay, it used to be with traditional sports that a lot of us would either go to the event, or we would go to our friend's house and we'd watch a game together there, or we'd go to a sports bar and watch a game together there. But COVID changed all of that, right? So sports, like one of the great things about sports is watching it with your friends and family, right? That's a huge part of the value of sports, is the social aspect of it. But we've all been kind of trained now to do social activities from remote locations. So we think about like, okay, how does that apply to an OTT scenario? Like, can we create a product with an interaction model where all of us, if we're all friends and we're all Celtics fans, can we watch the Celtics games together from remote locations, but still get that feeling like we're all in a room together, right? And how does that change the UI of the app? Can we create a room for just our friends and we all see our video as if we're on like a Zoom or a Teams call? And is that enough? Does that work? So like, that's a trend that we're talking about now, is like, I call it collaborative viewing, right? But for sports, like watching games together, it's more than just having a chat window. It's more than just, right? So we have to think about like, how do we create an experience? Because I think this is kind of the norm now, right? Like, I suspect that people are going to be interested in a way to watch sports with their friends from remote locations. So I see that as a trend, and I think you'll see more and more of that. Generally, back on that AI topic we were just talking about, I think 5 years ago, 5 years plus, it was all about collect data, like more data. How can we collect better data? How can we, you know, performance-wise, how can we track, you know, athletic performance, all that? That's been done, like that's being done, and that's easy to do now. And I know I'm kind of repeating myself, but decision-making is really the key here. And I think that every sport out there is now inundated with data, but I think there's a huge gap now between like what do we do with it? Right. Like, and it's not just understanding what the data means. Like, that's part of it. Right. So you get it all back and you look at it. Okay. He's running 3% slower than he ran off the line of scrimmage, you know, over the last 10 sessions, and he's trending down. Okay, great. You understand the data now. What do you do about it? How do you fix that, right? How can you use that data and combine it with training drills that you run, or medical data? How do you go and pull all this together to create a model that says, okay, now we can do something about it, right? That's, I think, where that's the trend. That's the next horizon, is make better decisions using this data. And a lot of that involves AI and predictive algorithms and things like that. But I think that's kind of the stage we're at now, is translating better understanding of our sport into results.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions. So pop on over to the sports creative community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.